Welcome to Revere Asset Management's Your Money with Danny Stewart.
The market will always overshoot to the downside and to the upside.
And Don Vandenborg.
Because it's not how much you make in the markets, it's how much of that you can keep.
Blue sky ahead, not a cloud on the horizon. The market's in an uptrend. We're at all-time highs, and it's blue sky all the way to Venus or Mars. However, valuations are extremely lofty, and all the questions I'm getting from everybody is, when is this going to roll over and sell off? How much further can this go? This can't keep going like this. This is crazy. That's a pretty good question, I guess. Now, hyperinflation fears abound. There's more chatter on the internet talking about the debt, our government debt, hyperinflation, Bitcoin, and gold. Now, is Bitcoin the answer? Is Bitcoin really digital gold, or is it digital pearls? I'm going to talk about that. That's an article in the Wall Street Journal I posted in the show notes. You can read that. And we have a great show today, or we were going to. I was going to be really prepared. I got to the office extra early this morning, and I got stuck in the elevator. True story. I got stuck for over an hour in the elevator, and you press the emergency button on the thing to get help. And only the elevator operator apparently can open the door for you. Can't be like this, just the maintenance guys at the building. And so the guy said, well, I'm 45 minutes to an hour out. Well, we're talking about DFW traffic. Ergo, I'm a little bit behind the curve, but hey, I'm going to wing it. Anyway. Some quick house cleaning. I also put on the show notes, what to know about the new bill targeting GRATs, grantor retained annuity trust, and other abusive trust for the wealthy, because those evil rich are not paying their fair share. So we got it. So anyway, if you are a little bit higher net worth, you may need to call me or review your estate stuff with a tax advisor, because they're coming under fire, and you may have to do some alternative strategies going forward, because a lot of the go-to favorites like the Grats, they may not be around too much longer, or they may be disadvantaged. Another article is the 10 big disagreements with the budget between the GOP and Biden, how to treat capital gains, carried interest, estate tax rules, which is what I was just talking about, how to tax global companies, just a whole bunch of other stuff. But, you know, tax is so boring, and I don't want to grind this show to the halt. So you can read it yourself, or if you want to find out more, because it's really on an individual basis, reach out to call me. I'd love to talk to you about that. Now, to go to the mailbag first or to read the, you know what? I think I'm going to go to the mailbag first, and then I'm going to read these articles, because they dovetail pretty perfectly with these things. And then I'll go to Don and the team, or more specifically Ted, because I think Connor's still off today. Or is Connor back in? Is Connor back in the saddle?
Nope.
That's what I thought. I thought he's coming back Monday. All right. So this is on 317. This is from AS. Hey, Don, good morning. I was wondering if you prefer using the 1 hour stochastic oscillator as your entry point consistently. By the way, I just wanted to let you know that I think your show is excellent. Thank you, AS. I almost said his name. Don, hi, AS. I use it most frequently when I'm trying to do smaller adds to existing profitable positions, once you've already got the position, usually in conjunction with a pullback or a bounce near the 21 exponential moving average during an uptrending market. Thanks for the kind words. That's pretty self-explanatory, Don. You don't want to add any color to that, do you?
I'll just bring up a 60-minute stochastic and show what I'm talking about here. This is just on the S&P 500, and really what we're looking for is when you get back below this 20 level, which indicates oversold, and then you see a hook back up. It's a low-risk entry. You can see normally there's nothing normal about the market. But you can see what happens if you're looking to put some capital to work. You don't want to do it when it's up here, because you're just inevitably waiting for a very short-term pullback. You can put the odds in your favor of limiting your downside and getting a positive response immediately if you wait for this hook back up through that 20 over sold level. So that's a very short-term entry tactic that we use.
Yeah, and if you look at that, folks, so that top chart is kind of the stochastic, right? And then, because I got the thing in the way, yeah. And then you see the S&P in the different levels, right? And you can see how that really kind of, that real high correlation. So if you know you want to get in and you're buying on that bottom, that market usually rallies up with that. So it's good for timing short-term entries. All right, next one. This is 318 from MB. You know what? We're going to do this other one first, and then we're going to come back to these last two, because these last two are actually going to be part of the topic of the show. Don, if you want to bring that slide up we were talking about, but 320, and this is from RR. I am not a client, only an individual investor who has been following your videos for a while. Just an idea for you to consider. You may want to mention how you manage clients' money. Since I am not a client, I don't know for sure, but my impression is the client's money is held in their own personal account at TDA or Schwab, now Schwab. Assets are not commingled. Correct. We do not pool accounts. It's not a hedge fund. It's not a mutual fund. It's your own individual account. Now, we buy everything at the block level, so it's allocated amongst everybody in that same strategy. So if you're in that strategy, you're getting the exact same price and timestamp as me, Don, and my elderly mother. There is no front running. There is no cherry picking. Everybody gets the same average price. Secondly, Revere has only has authority.
Sorry, Zach, can you show? There we go. Okay, good. Go ahead, Dan.
So Don's showing you this thing in bullet point form. Two, Revere only has authority to enter buy and sell orders in the client's accounts and management fees. Yes, we have limited discretion. We can only execute trades and charge management fees. We can't go in there and move money around, send money to you or any third parties. We can set up and tie in your bank account and make it directly to you, first party, you to you, with something signed by you. And then if you call up and say, hey, Danny, I need some money. Would you send me some money? I can send it to your own bank account with matching titling. If it doesn't match exactly, you're going to have to sign something each time there's money movement. And incidentally, you can call Schwab on your own and take care of it yourself. You don't need us. So we're actually primarily for the strategy. We do the holistic maintenance if we need to. All right, three, clients continue to receive statements from TDA Schwab and can log in to TDA Schwab to check their own accounts at any time. That is true. It is your account. You have access. You can log in anytime. You can see anything. Four, trades placed at Revere are averaged across all accounts, and the clients get the same exact price for any given trade. I just explained that. Yes. No Bernie Madoff action at Revere. Thanks, RR. Don, thanks for the input, RR. Me, do you need a marketing job? I'm kidding. Anyway, so he's absolutely right, folks. We are a fee-based only fiduciary. There are no conflicts of interest. We don't even accept referral fees, right? And that's how you get Madoff, though, is if you have the custodian and the advisor are one and the same. So if you're getting advice from the same place you're custodying assets, there's a little bit higher risk there. That's how Madoff'd everybody. He was the advisor and the custodian, okay? So if money is stolen out of your account, call Schwab. By the way, they've got lots of insurance. Last time I checked, it was unlimited, previously from $150 million. So you really don't even have any worries until you're over at least $150 million. That's private insurance by Lloyd's of London, by the way. Anyway, I digress. Now, let's go to these other two, and both of these articles are in the show notes, on 318 MB. Good advice from the article that Revere Asset Management is following. If you make a bet, keep it small and hedge it if you can. You say that Bitcoin is a digital gold. Maybe it's digital pearls. Almost every previously disruptive technology has ended up being disrupted itself. Bitcoin could be too. And we're going to talk about that. And then I said, this is how we participate in Bitcoin. But why do many people think it is the solution? And number two, if the power, well, here's the argument, folks. A lot of these Bitcoin groupies, there's people that think Bitcoin is the be all end all. It may be, I don't know, right? But if the logic is that they can't, you can't, it's not divisible. It's like gold. There's a finite supply. It's not a fiat currency. Okay. But it also is to protect against paper assets. If these people, these all powerful people, are really controlling everything, you think they're going to let you run away with Bitcoin? And in other words, the US dollar, the government is not going to allow something to supplant the US dollar, at least not yet. Okay. We've gone to war for that. We've gone to war in the Middle East many times for the petrodollar. Okay. Understand history. So now they may somehow incorporate Bitcoin and use its platform to become the US digital dollar. That I don't know, because the US government definitely wants digital money. They want digital currency because they can track everything you do now. So I don't really know how it's going to play out, but I've got a very good article that may shed some light on it, give you a little bit different perspective if you're hardcore Bitcoin. And lastly, 317, this is from N on Twitter. She sends me private messages on Twitter all the time and different articles. And this article, this is a YouTube video from Dr. Ingo Sawyer. And you can go Google that and look at it yourself. And it's basically on hyperinflation and the central bank insolvencies. And that will tie into our Bitcoin. Incidentally, most of the inflation doomers, they're also the people that are writing a lot of these articles. If you look, they're also really hardcore pushing Bitcoin. So with that, I am going to go with this article very quick because it's very stimulating and it's a good article to think about. And don't just use it for Bitcoin. Think about it for almost any asset class, okay? You say Bitcoin is a digital gold, maybe it's digital pearls. That's the headline of this Wall Street Journal article. Almost every previously disruptive technology has ended up being disrupted. Bitcoin could be too. Are you a Tesla gold groupie? Bitcoin or not? All right, now, this is the kind of the story very quickly. In 1917, Maisie Plant, the wife of a rich businessman, he's very wealthy. He lived in Manhattan right off the park. And basically it's a cautionary tale, but he basically traded his mansion by Central Park for $1 million string of pearls, Cartier pearls. Okay. But he nor Cartier, this millionaire, billionaire, well, be billionaire today, millionaire then, and Cartier had no idea that Japanese entrepreneur Koichi Mochimoto had industrialized the technology to create cultured pearls. The price of natural pearls collapsed and stayed down for decades. Only recently have they been revived, by the way, because people even want the natural pearls, just like the diamonds. They can make those synthetic diamonds where they can etch in a serial number and they can make them, and they're far cheaper. Well, it put pressure on the price of natural diamonds at first, but then natural diamonds, they said, wait a minute, I want the natural ones. They're more special. They come out of the ground. In any event, the point being is this Cartier necklace that they paid $1 million for, at her auction after she died in 1957, sold for $151,000. So they lost basically 85% on that deal. Like I said, in recent years, natural pearls have rebounded. Now, that estate that he traded for the $1 million pearls in 2016 sold for $525 million. Okay, now, in early 2000s, people correctly forecasted the internet would change the world. Cisco Systems was the backbone of the internet, and that stock made 100% on average all through the 90s. Every just nailed it, right? However, pretty soon it became, and everybody thought Cisco was the stock to own. And it was in the 90s, but then it became a commodity. And then it got supplanted by the cloud computing, which was Amazon and Microsoft, and they kind of overtook Cisco. Now, talking about some of these other here's what he's saying is, the code that powers Bitcoin, like all software, it is a software, requires periodic updating, and it's prone to bugs. In the past, when they've updated the Bitcoin software, they've never severely been impaired. However, if programming flaws go undetected long enough, it could compromise the stability and security of the Bitcoin network, dealing a severe blow to the currency value. Maybe, maybe not. Who knows? All I'm saying is that is a software. Okay. Even the prospectus of the new Bitcoin warns that the currencies could come along, different digital currencies could come along and also reduce the value, or it could be a better mousetrap, a better type of Bitcoin currency, cryptocurrency that is not divisible. Okay. But he was talking about some companies. So remember that Commodore and Atari were the first computers, the very first ones. And they were rocketing for just a little while. But then they got buried by Apple and IBM. Go.com and InfoSeek were crushed by Yahoo, which was in turn decimated by Google. The first social media companies were Friendster, if you remember that one, and MySpace. And that was obliterated by Facebook. Point being is, you can never, there's always new innovation. And Bitcoin, although it's supposed to emulate gold, gold is a physical commodity. It's a hard commodity. So it's a little bit different than Bitcoin. Bitcoin has software, it's technology. It's just not the same as gold, in my opinion. Now, that's why you make the undiversified bet that Bitcoin scarcity and uniqueness are unassailable. So here's what he's recommending, this article. If you make a bet, keep it small and hedge it if you can. Whole point is, this guy's saying that Bitcoin is not the be-all, end-all, and or it might be, but just take it with caution, because a lot of things that people thought in the past were going to be that stock that you can stick in the drawer forever and give to your grandkids turned out to be a dud after the first decade, after they first had it. All right. So that's the Bitcoin story. And I'll let Don and the group talk about how that looks on a chart and all that stuff a little bit later. The second article is blackouts of buybacks threaten our bullish run. Now, this is very interesting. So in the last half of March, this month, blackouts for stock purchases threaten the liquidity support for this bullish run. So folks, when stocks are about to go into earnings, right before earnings for a month or two, they've got to go into a blackout and they can't do their buybacks. They can't buy back their own shares. So the demand for the demand from buybacks, from the companies buying their own shares, is greatly diminished. Now, this guy on this article, he's saying that 57% of stock increase prices is based on earnings. 27% is based on share buybacks. Let's round it to 30. Now, only 9% is from dividends. It's got a good dividend. We'll buy it because of that. And 6% from multiple expansions, meaning PE ratios and getting better. Now, here's one thing that you got to remember, though. Share buybacks is kind of a manipulation of earnings per share, and it gooses up earnings per share. So on that 57% is based on earnings, meaning earnings looking better. When you do share buybacks, you artificially make earnings look better. So a portion of that 57% of the earnings, you know, stock increase attributable to earnings, could actually be people buying because of the stock, the share buybacks juice the earnings, help the earnings a little bit, and people unknowingly bought it because of the earnings. Okay. So in any event, point being is, the second biggest variable by far is share buybacks. Now, do you know when the blackout period for share buybacks ceased last time? It was right at the beginning of November. That's when this rally, this big rally, started. That's when we've had this big rally. And so now what he's saying is, it's just something to monitor. Now, He said between the Fed's massive injecting liquidity and corporate buybacks, there have actually been no other real buybacks. So the corporate buybacks, the share buybacks, have accounted for all net new purchases and even exceeded the Fed's quantitative easing. In other words, there were more billions of dollars with share buybacks than there were from quantitative easing. Okay, so the three primary drivers: first, earnings season, then the window reopens, blackout in November, and once that was lifted, we started rallying. He said there's a very high correlation, and it's 0.85%. So the main thing is that he is saying that when these share buybacks go into effect, the biggest buyers of equities are going to drop for about by about 35%. So 35% of some buying volume is going to dry up in the next month or two. And by the way, the sky's not falling. I'm not saying this is the next bear market. That's not the economic crisis. Could be. But what he's saying is don't be surprised if we get a sharp or a short-term pullback or even correction. The good news is after the blackout period subsides, we got $1 trillion of share buybacks throughout the rest of the year. So the share buybacks are going to come back in. He's just saying they're very seasonal, very seasonality with earning, and they correspond to earnings season. Right before earnings season, you got a big share buyback blackout. And then once you get halfway through or through earnings season, they get removed and the share buybacks come back into play. So with that, it doesn't matter what this guy thinks about share buybacks. It doesn't matter what you think about Bitcoin feelings or whether you're a groupie or not. The only thing that matters is price. Price is truth, and that's how we're going to manage our portfolios. So with that, Don, what is truth telling us? What is price telling us?
Well, let's go to a chart of the ETF that represents Bitcoin futures so you can get proper perspective of what has been going on for Bitcoin. And it was in a very long base from April 2023 until around November of 2023, where it traded in a tight range and just went sideways. And as is typical for any asset, really, nothing goes straight up, nothing goes straight down. You want it to go sideways at times because it's just coiling for a move. And in this case, we saw a breakout higher. And everybody was waiting for these Bitcoin spot ETFs to be approved. There were a bunch of big asset managers, big ETF providers that had applications into the SEC, and they hadn't gotten approval yet. The SEC finally approved them all on Thursday, January 11th, and Bitcoin promptly sold. It was a sell the news event. So basically all we do is wait for a proper entry point at that stage, and we got one right here, beginning of February. I hope you can't hear my dogs barking. They're trying to say hello to everybody. So here's a breakout. Here's the breakout of Bitcoin, and this is where we entered, and we wrote it up. It got extended. We took profits when it was extended. It pulled back again, and we re-entered after this big shakeout day right here. This is when Bitcoin made an all-time high, and then it reversed and pulled back, got back into the top part of the range. We took a re-entry. The second re-entry, when we sold it, we got about 40% gains. Right now, we're sitting on about 6 or 7% losses on a small, less than a quarter size position. And it's pulling back. There's this big Bitcoin halvening. Not a word you'll hear in everyday vernacular, but it has to do with the algorithm requiring twice as much power to generate the same amount of Bitcoin, as Bitcoin has a finite number that can ever be mined. And that's the way that they handle the creation of it and make it harder to do. But Bitcoin right now is just kind of pulling back in this channel. The 50-day moving average is right here around the 25 level. It can safely pull back to there, which was actually the prior breakout, and still be healthy. Our preference is that it holds on to this 21-day moving average. But like anything, Dan, you said it, we treat it like anything else in the portfolio. We're not going to ride it down. If it gets extended, we're going to take profits. We just follow our regular rules for investing in everything. This is just ridiculously overhyped, and it just has its detractors, and it has people that get so excited when they hear the word that their eyes literally turn into lasers. And we'll see where it goes. We're non-judgmental. We're not advocates
agnostic
or haters.
Agnostic.
Yeah, we're agnostic. Yeah.
Well, and, so here's how you knew Bitcoin was really going to rise like that real quick, right? When they started doing all those Bitcoin ETFs, because those big, huge ETF aggregators like BlackRock, they're priming the pump. They're priming. Are you getting primed by the pump? Are you getting played? Did you get played? If you don't have a sell discipline, you might, because normally when they come out with some new ETFs around a sector, they just like when they do an IPO, the underwriters are supposed to kind of support that stock for a few days and then let it go. With this, it took a little bit longer, but in any event, we'll have to see how that goes. So what are the
own? This is I'm showing a chart of what we actually own here. The IBIT. This is the most liquid, and it's an iShares product. They've got very good relationship or a very good reputation for putting out quality products at reasonable expense ratios. And here, the first day it came out, everything reversed. No different than that. What I showed on that chart of BITO. Then volume dried up, it popped, we bought it, it broke out of a very nice cup and handle. We rode it till it got extended, and we're sitting right on the 21-day moving average now. But we don't care as long as it's going up. O'Neill said the same thing about stocks. All stocks are bad unless they're going up.
Right. So right there, keep that chart up. What is going to make you hold and what is going to make you sell on that?
Well, the 50-day moving average doesn't show on here because it hasn't been trading for 50 days yet, which is ironic. But these charts are this level, the equivalent of this 25 level, we would bail on it here if it broke below the 50-day moving average, which was also the prior breakout level. It should not break below that level. If it does, it may be time for, everybody's talking about this Bitcoin halving too, and they're getting all lathered up about that. That may be another sell the news event where we clear out of the way and just wait for it to settle down. But right now, it went on a run. It's pulling back. It's a neutral. It's neutral here. We're holding. It's a hold for us.
Yeah. So in the article, he talks about approximately 19 million Bitcoins already exist, and the rate of new issue, and it's effectively fixed at 21 million. And so he said the new issuance is scheduled to decline over time until the last Bitcoin is created in 2140. So you're getting, it's kind of economies of scale in reverse. You're getting diminishing returns because it's taking more and more energy to mine fewer and fewer coins. That's kind of what you were alluding to, Don. And so there may be some headwinds, structural headwinds with Bitcoin down the road. And that's why I'm saying don't put all your eggs in just one basket.
Yeah, it's got a big tailwind of all the big asset managers changing the prospectuses for a lot of their products to be able to hold Bitcoin inside of it. So it's got a big tailwind, maybe some temporary headwinds, but a huge tailwind.
Yep, absolutely. All right, well, let's start talking about the markets, the stock market and the bond market, because the biggest question I'm getting right now, Don, is how much further can the market go?
Well, we've been rallying pretty much nonstop since the beginning of November, but we've taken a couple of pauses along the way. It's never straight up. It looks straight up here, but if you break it down closer and you watch the nightly videos like we talk about, there have been several 4 to 5 week consolidations, and then they've been met with subsequent breakouts. And that's what we just got on Wednesday with the Fed, with the FOMC rate decision and the Q&A of Powell. It's really no different from the breakout that we had here on January 19th. I've got it marked as an inflection point there, and that was just a break above a four-week consolidation level. We went higher. Then we had another breakout here. This was on NVIDIA's earnings and a big rally on anything AI or data center related. That was on February 22nd. We went up. We traded in a 19-day tight range since then, and then we broke out again this past Wednesday. And as long as you hold that breakout level, there is absolutely positively nothing wrong with the market. You can say that it's extended and you can't buy here, but really this is a very low risk entry. And if we break below this level, it's a change in character, because what uptrends just can just make higher highs and higher lows. And that's all that we've been doing with subsequent periods of going sideways. We've had two sideways periods. And in last Friday night's video, I asked, is it early January where we were consolidating and went higher? Or is it last July where after a nice run, we had a big topping candle and then we went into a three waves down multi-month correction? And the answer as of right now is it's January. We broke out and we're holding the breakout. If we break back below the level of the breakout level, then it's a failed breakout and we react accordingly. It's just following the rules. It's not arguing with the market. It's just riding the wave, which is what we've been saying ever since this November 1st, November 2nd inflection point that kicked off the whole rally in the first place. You never know how long it's going to go. And, you know, we've been saying that more money has been lost anticipating corrections than during the corrections themselves. And a lot of people can't believe that this just continues to go higher, but it has gone higher. and that's all we've been doing. You know, you don't you say in the introduction of the video
the markets will
they'll overshoot to the upside and the downside. You see it all the time.
And here's another thing from a fundamental standpoint. If you look, I'm pretty good at fundamentals, been known to be anyway, get lucky every once in a while. If everybody goes, oh, these PEs, look at all this stuff. But remember, you're also talking about stocks in terms of dollars. In other words, if the dollar is going down, getting devalued, it's becoming, that can inflate stock prices. The money capital will find the path of least resistance. So if you've got a choice of having something in fixed dollars, but you're worried about the dollar, or you want more assets, now a stock is still kind of a paper asset, but they've got buildings, they've got cash flow. I mean, it's real assets. And so maybe people are voting with their dollars that they'd rather have equities than dollars. So if you look at the stock market in terms of gold, we're not at all-time highs. But if you look at the stock market in terms of dollars, because everything is always relative, we're at all-time highs. So does that mean the stock market is all-time highs, or does that mean the dollar is just lower? That's food for thought. All right, Don.
I put a number on the screen here. This is where we were trading at 2 p.m. Eastern time on Wednesday when the FOMC announcement came out, 51.74. As long as the S&P is above 51.74, we continue to be in a very bullish trend higher.
So if you've got an advisor somewhere else, ask them, hey, are you watching that 51.74 number? And just see what they say. I'd just be curious. I'll be curious to know what that means. All right. What has Teddy got for us today?
Ted's got some really good stuff about portfolio management and tracking statistics. Take it away, Ted.
Yep. So I just want to talk about trading statistics and a few kind of charts I look at almost every day, definitely every week. And I think if you want to be serious about you're trading and investing, you have to track these stats. On the top left, you can zoom in a little bit. These are the major statistics you should track: your average gain percentage, average loss, average dollar amount. I shaded those out because I just didn't want to show the dollar amount. Average holding period for a win, average holding period for a loss, largest win percentage, largest loss percentage. And then I also have like just number of trades per time period. And as you can see, I can select like last 3 months, last 6 months, last 12 months, year to date. And then on the right side of that left chart, it plots my win-loss ratio, the average win and loss, and then it normalizes it for adjusted risk reward. And if you have above a one, it means you actually have an edge. So I know I have an edge in the last 3 months in my trading. And if it drops below one, that's definitely a big red flag. The bottom right is a chart that tracks the last, like the statistics of the last 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 trades. And I have the top, I have the last 5, 10, and 20 bolded because that's the most important to me. And when I start seeing deterioration in the average win percentage, as well as the P&L and the adjusted risk to reward, that really tells me to slow down, take smaller size, keep stops tighter, and maybe even take profits quicker. As you can see, the adjusted risk reward turned red, and I just have like an Excel function that turns red when it's below one. In the last 5 to 10 trades, those are about 0.5, and that's why I brought down my sizing to at least half the normal risk that I would want to take on trades. And I've been even more selective in my focus lists and stocks that I'm willing to buy, and just overall exposure in general. About the periods, like last 3 months, last 6 months, last 12 months, every week I would go through those and I'd start from last 12 months and just see how my stats change through time and see whether it's improving or deteriorating all the way up until like last week. And that really gives me a feeling of how my trading is going, if it's improving, if it's just neutral, or if it's deteriorating. And then I adjust my tactics based on what I'm seeing. Don, if you move on, I just want to show
Ted,
a couple other charts that I track.
Real quick, I want to add one more thing on that. It's not only does that help Ted track his own personal discipline and what he's doing, it also gives him strong signals about the market. Because when you talk about market breadth, advancers versus decliners, how strong the trend is, when we're just beginning an uptrend and we're just early in a bull market, if you will, Ted's going to have a lot of success and the win loss is going to be big, and it's good. The statistics are going to look much better as you get longer in the tooth, and it becomes harder and harder, and there's fewer winners, that his numbers are going to deteriorate some. Even though he's still doing a very disciplined job and doing a great job, that's just giving him feedback that the market has gotten tougher.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why he's saying, when I see it getting tougher, I'm going to trim down my position sizes. So it's not just Ted tracking himself. He's actually tracking the market and how strong or weak the market is.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And just track my numbers through time. It gives me objective data about my own trading. It's not just based off my feeling, even though I do have some discretion involved in my trading. Having my numbers makes it more systematic than if you don't know your numbers at all. And also, when you know your average gain in a period of time and you track that through time, that is what the market is giving you. So it's not what you think what you'll get on the upside. It's what the market is actually giving you on the upside, based on your average gain for all your trades. And with that, that's where you can then adjust your stop loss based off what the market's giving you and maintain that risk reward ratio. And so I've learned that your stop loss should be a function of your average gain. And so, for example, if the market's only giving you 6% on the upside, you can't have an average 5% stop loss, or else you just don't have an edge anymore. So you have to, at least for me, maintain a 2-to-1 risk reward ratio. So if I had an average gain of 6%, I'd want to take loss around 3%. If the market doesn't give you stocks that give you that downside parameter, then you just sit out until the upside increases. So that's just the last point I wanted to talk about on that last slide. This one, the top left chart is just all my trades plotted out of the last 3 months. Red is losers and blue is winners. And this just gives me a visualization of, am I keeping my stops tight and letting winners run? And clearly in the last 3 months, I am. All my winners are a lot bigger on average than my losers. And the right side of that chart is the most recent. So I can see if there's a proliferation of losers piling up, and that can tell me to put on, press the brakes, stop trading, or just trade less. And then the bottom right is pretty self-explanatory. It's just the equity curve of my profit and loss plotted with the 10-day simple moving average. And ever since I started tracking this, I felt that my trading has been a lot more consistent, a lot less volatile, and just smoother overall equity curve in general. And when I break that 10-day simple moving average, just like a stock, or like I couldn't get the 8 EMA, so I just had the 10 SMA, pretty much the same thing, the 8, 9, 10, all track around the same thing. But when I break the 10 SMA on my equity curve, it doesn't really matter what the market is giving you. If your own trading is poor, you need to take a step back and see what's going on. And as you can see, this most recent break of the 10 SMA, that's when I really reduced sizing and my aggressiveness. I've kind of flatlined. And that's exactly what I want to see so that I can make new highs on my equity curve when the setups start coming back into the markets and when the momentum comes back to the markets as well, and when institutional support and appetite increases. And then the final chart I wanted to share. So trading in itself is just a statistic and probabilities game. You're going to take hundreds and thousands of trades over your career if you stay in this game. And from that, you'll usually have a normal distribution of trades if you just take trades almost randomly. But the whole goal of trading is to cut off the left side of the normal distribution so that you don't have outliers on the loss column, or fat tails, as it is called in statistics. And when you do have a stop loss and you adhere to it with discipline, this is what a proper distribution of your trade should look like. As you can see, I have a lot of small losers. And then on the right side, I have the big winners, or fat tails. And that one above 75%, that was SMCI. And I talked about that on our trades review tab. And that probably accounted for over 25% of my gain this year. And this refers back to what I talked about last podcast about the 80-20 principle. As you can see, there aren't that many trades on the right side of my distribution, but that makes up over 80% of my gain for this year. And so whenever I describe trading to someone like a newer trader, I kind of just pull up a normal distribution, cut off the left side, and just tell them this is the goal of trading. Cut losers quick, keep them small, and let winners ride as long as the market allows you to ride them.
100% eliminating large losses. If you can just do that one thing, forget about the ego of insisting on being right. Forget about any. Sometimes you see things that trading systems have, 92% success rate, that they're picking up nickels in front of the steamroller. If that's your percent of your success rate, the people that trade the way we do, O'Neill, Minervini, you've got a lot of small losers. Your number of wins is below 50% compared to your losses, but those wins are magnitudes higher in a percentage gain versus all of the tiny losses that you have. Great stuff, Ted. And that's a great tool that you're using to track all of this data. Dan, I think that's it from the portfolio side. You can take it away.
Yeah, listen, and folks, kind of to oversimplify, to make it kind of simple, we don't know which stocks are going to go up and be the next big winner like SMCI. I mean, if we knew that, I'd own the small island Hawaii and I wouldn't need your money. And by the way, it's your money. It's not the investment bank's money. That's why we named this show Your Money. Wall Street thinks it's their money, but it's your money. In any event, when we buy, I'm going to oversimplify here. We buy 10 stocks. Three or four of them will have single-digit losses. They'll get stopped out. And then we'll have a handful that have single-digit gains or maybe slight double-digit gains. They start to roll over and we book them at 9, 10, 11, 12. And those small losses and those small gains will kind of offset each other. And then you'll have one or two that just are runners and win. And like Don and Ted said, the lion's share of your gains will all come from just a couple of stocks, but it's the law of large numbers and you're keeping your losses small. So it's a smoother ride. Folks, it makes it easier. I do think it's a better mousetrap, especially if you're a little bit queasy about the markets, a little scared about the markets, or if you think these valuations are very, very high. I would be very terrified. It's probably a little strong. Well, maybe not. Depends on your personality. But I would be very scared right now to do an asset allocation pie chart at these valuations and just throw it in there. I would not do that. The only time I really would, well, I even wouldn't want to do it then, but the only time that really works consistently, smoothly, is when you come right off of a bear market and you're buying in somewhere near the bottom. But at these lofty levels, I mean, I don't know if we're in the sixth inning or the ninth inning, but we're certainly not in the top three or four innings, right? So I need a discipline. And I'm not going to do an asset allocation model because all correlations grow together and they all go down together in a bear market. Only a couple things will do well. Cash, money market, treasury bonds, maybe gold. And when gold and treasuries are positively correlated, that's normally a fear trade. In 2008, the only two things that did well were gold and treasuries. Everything else got creamed, even investment grade corporate bonds. Okay, so if you had a diversified portfolio, you lost a blended rate of 35%. If you had all stocks and hardly any bonds, you lost a blended rate of 50% or 45, 50. We don't want to do that. Folks, listen, if you like what you heard, please tell a friend, tell a neighbor. Just send them to revereasset.com up in the right-hand corner. There's a subscribe button. They can put their name and email in there, and we're not going to hassle them or spam them or junk mail them. It's up to them to reach out to us if they want a complimentary portfolio review or just want a stock they want talked about on the program. In fact, there's a contact us button next to the subscribe button. It shoots an email me directly, and you can reach out and say, hey, would you talk about this topic, or here's a stock I want you guys to go over on the show. Or you just want a complimentary portfolio review, and all of our stuff goes into your inbox. Don does a video every night, and we do this podcast on Friday morning. And if you're a YouTube subscriber, just go to Revere Asset. This will go into your inbox. You'll have this show by probably 1 o'clock Central Time on Friday before the market closes. Folks, you can email any of us, Dan at revereasset.com. Don at revereasset.com, Ted or Connor at revereasset.com, or you could always, always, always call us old school at 855-REAL-WEALTH. Have a safe and happy weekend, and we'll talk to you next week on your money, not their money, your money.
Because it's not about how much you make in the market, it's about how much you can keep. 5174 is the level.
Your Money Radio podcast covers general topics and investment ideas for research. It is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and is not meant to be investment advice. If you want or need investment advice, contact your own advisors or reach out to Revere Asset Management for individual investment advice. For more information, just go to revereasset.com.